the Iranians are committing to a ceasefire and the Israelis are committing to a ceasefire. So it seems to me that Trump did exactly what I suspected he would do. You know, he put himself at the head of the stampeding herd, and basically he led them and then led them astray. So in the end, the United States avoided going to war against Iran. There was no regime change in Iran, which is exactly what the neocons wanted. And the United States carries on negotiating with Iran and mediating peace with Israel, along with the Qataris. So far, so good, Andy. But the problem is still...
Alex Craner, good afternoon, or good morning to me, but good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well, Andy. Good to join you again, and warm greeting to all your viewers and listeners.
Thank you. You're one of the most asked about people, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, but with my viewers, you're one of the most asked and sought after people. Let's try to make sense what's going on in the Middle East, getting up to date. Trump just, and I want to say Trump, correct me if I'm wrong, announced a ceasefire. I'm not sure if that was the case, but let's give me your thoughts. What's going on and how does this work out?
So it's very difficult to interpret events if you go by the media narratives, if you go by the hype, which is coming from a lot of sides, you know, because you have a normal distribution, the Gaussian curve. So you have a lot of people in between who are plain confused. And then you have one fat tail is the TDS people, the Trump derangement syndrome people. And on the opposite end, you have the TLS people, the Trump loyalty syndrome people. And so between all them, a lot of thoughts and interpretations are being bounced around, and we're all guessing because nobody is coming out, spelling it out and saying, okay, this is what we're doing and this is the reason. So, you know, Trump himself is playing a tricky game, and I, like most people, I'm obliged to, you know, kind of look at the tea leaves and try to interpret the situation as best I can. So I've been for the longest time, well, longest time, it's been weeks, right? Since let's say mid-March when he started Operation Rough Rider bombing Yemen, I've been at pains to interpret what Trump was doing in the Middle East because the whole thing was so incredibly stupid that I thought there's no way this is what it is. You know, like it looks like something, but it can't possibly be that, because even if you know by, if you, even if you go by the, you know, like people who hate Trump and say that he's really stupid, low IQ, and that people around him are all low IQ people, and even that is, even if you take that into account, his actions in the Middle East are still too dumb still. And so I thought there's something else to this. You know, he wouldn't be just attacking Iran just like that, you know, declaring war or not declaring war but waging it all the same. Because there's very little to gain, and there's a huge deal of risk involved. You know, there's about 20 military bases in the Middle East, up to 60,000 U.S. troops on the ground. There's all these naval assets, you know, carrier strike groups in the Red Sea, near the Persian Gulf, that could be reached by Iranian missiles. If, you know, I don't think that Trump would want 5,000 sailors in the bottom of the Indian Ocean on his conscience because of something stupid he had done, like attacking Iran. So I thought, maybe, you know, maybe they obviously did talk to each other, the Iranians with the American delegations. And maybe, you know, Trump said, look, I can't hold these people back. These people, meaning all the hysterical Jewish Zionists and Christian evangelicals who desperately want war against Iran. And, you know, along with them, all the corporate military industrial complex and banking interests who also want that for their own reasons. Because remember, when Witkoff went to talk to the Iranians at one point in May, I think, last month, he came back to the United States and he thought he had a deal in the bag because he got the Iranians to commit not to enrich uranium to weapons grade, to limit, you know, to 3.75, whatever it is, percent. And then when he came back, you know, the neocons and these Zionist people, they wanted his head and they wanted Hegseth. Hegseth said, because he voted against bombing Iran at that point. And so obviously the situation was very tense. And these people were very hysterical and the pressure on Trump was probably getting very, very difficult to cope with. So, you know, if you can't stand them there and take on like a stampeding crowd running at you, then maybe you put yourself at the head of them and you run them to off a cliff, right? So I thought maybe Trump went to the Iranians and said, hey, look, oh, and also please keep in mind that suddenly about 10 days ago or so, Iranians announced that they were in possession of all these detailed files on Israeli nuclear program, terabytes worth of data, right? Okay, so maybe Trump and his people went to the Iranians and said, look, we can't hold these people back. The situation is getting out of hand. We're going to have to do something. So why don't we arrange like an attack? We're going to bomb you. Then you're going to have to retaliate. So retaliate, but, you know, don't retaliate too bigly, right? And then we're going to each declare victory and we're going to call for truce, for peace. And so, and also another reason why I thought something like this must have been going on, in addition to Trump policy on the face of it being like dumber than dumb, is because it's completely at odds with Trump's previously announced positions on the Middle East, right? And I'm not talking just over the past 6 months. Even in his prior administration, you know, he didn't want to wage war everywhere. He didn't want the United States to be the enforcement arm of the Western Empire. He tried to bring troops back from Afghanistan and from Syria and from Europe. And now, you know, all of a sudden he's there defending hegemony of the Western powers in the Middle East for the chief benefit of the European nations and the cheap cost of the United States in terms of blood and treasure. So none of it made sense to me. And then not to forget, the people who want this war are practically exactly the same people who have been hounding Trump for the past 8 years, putting him through one impeachment after another, roasting him in the media 24/7. And now suddenly he's championing their cause. None of that makes any sense to me. Anyway, okay, so I thought, let's see what happens. If the American attack on Iran looks like a lot of fireworks and nothing meaningful, then maybe it was a deal. And then if Iranian retaliation is the same, then more reason to think that it was a deal. And so the whole thing started to remind me of the World Wrestling Federation, you know, where, you know, they make this big show of great violence and these big fights, but it's all fake, right? And then, you know, everything is garnished and backed up with the trash talk that's equally, like, abrasive and violent, but also fake, you know. These people then go for a drink together and have a barbecues and so forth. So I thought, let's see. Anyway, as it turns out, the U.S. attacks on Iran were, you know, negligible, didn't achieve a thing. Iranian retaliation against the United States, same thing, nothing happened. They told them, we're going to hit this base. So they evacuated everybody, not a single casualty, right? And then everybody turns around and declares victory. And now they're going to negotiate peace. And J.D. Vance is announcing a new era of peace and prosperity in the Middle East. And the Iranians are committing to a ceasefire, and the Israelis are committing to a ceasefire. So it seems to me that Trump did exactly what I suspected he would do. You know, he put himself at the head of the stampeding herd, and basically he led them and then led them astray. So in the end, the United States avoided going to war against Iran. There was no regime change in Iran, which is exactly what the neocons wanted. And the United States carries on negotiating with Iran and mediating peace with Israel, along with the Qataris. So far, so good, Andy. But the problem is still Syria, you know, because, you know, the neocons are not as powerful in the United States, even though they're very, very few and they represent essentially nobody. They're not as that powerful just like that, you know. The something, somebody's backing them. And it looks to me that there's a lot of interlocking relationships between the leading neocons and people in the British foreign policy establishment and the intelligence agencies. And, you know, for them, the name of the game is not peace or stability, it's hegemony. And the requirement to defend the hegemony is obviously to have decisive mediation role in, you know, who gets what chunk of the Middle East to develop to as their market, as you know, their natural resource wealth, and so forth. And so this always is going to be drawing back to the European colonial powers, like primarily Britain and France, but then also others to a lesser extent, like Holland, Belgium, and so forth. Anyway, the preservation of the Iranian regime and peace at this stage are running exactly counter of the European colonial interests. And, you know, the Obama administration, the Clinton administration, and the Biden administration were all serving these European colonial interests, which is what I think is the problem in the United States. Because, you know, this is not just Trump opposing this. I think there's a much more broad-based opposition to this. And part of why Trump walked out on the JCPOA is because, you know, again, the United States found itself in the position of kind of like a guarantor of the deal and, you know, the chief policeman, while the spoils of this agreement were almost completely given to the European investment houses. So, you know, long story short, it seems to me that Trump kind of tricked them all, that he cornered the Israelis. Because, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu was in such desperate, dire straits politically that he had to jump on this and declare victory and celebrate his partnership with Trump and thank Trump profusely for, you know, doing this and blah, blah, blah. And now that it turns out it's all fake, apparently, he can't just go out there and say, oh, I was duped. He has to own it now. It's very difficult to back out. And so now, even in Israel, there's a lot of talk about holding early elections, which will spell the end of Netanyahu's political career and probably his life as a free man. And then God knows what happens to Israel. Israel could descend into a civil war, as could Syria. And in fact, I think this could all be the end of the Zionist project as we know it. We have to always keep in mind, you know, because this is something that, you know, in pretty much has become a cultural fact, that Israel was created as a homeland for the, you know, long-suffering Jewish people, where they would be safe and where they could live happily ever after. But in fact, that's a lie itself. The Israel has always been a British imperial project, which was, you know, it was inserted into the Middle East exactly for the purpose of keeping it constantly destabilized. Israel has been pretty at war with one or the other of its neighbors pretty much the whole time since its creation. And it's been fulfilling that role because, you know, it was Israelis who were like, oh, we have to take down Saddam Hussein. You know, if you take down Saddam Hussein, region will be at peace. Oh, we have to take down Bashar al-Assad. If we do that, we're going to have peace. Oh, now we have to take out the Iranians. Oh, we need a regime change in Lebanon. We need to dismantle Hezbollah. Oh, we also need to dismantle Hamas, which we created ourselves because we wanted to sabotage the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Oh, we have to go to war against Yemen. And so, you know, they have been there antagonizing their neighbors for decades, Egypt included, and then creating pretext for Western powers to come in and intervene. And that has pretty much been the recipe of having hegemony over the region. And so nobody was worried about Iranian nuclear weapons, just as nobody's concerned about Israeli nuclear weapons. They needed a regime change because they wanted a cooperative regime in Iran. But now what Trump has done is forcing Israelis into a peace negotiations without delivering the regime change in Iran. So I think the situation is extremely interesting. And to me, it seems like a distinctly positive development, but we still have Syria. And Syria is now largely under the decisive influence of the British. The Turkish deep state is basically their proxy there, along with the jihadis, the HTS, and their president al-Jolani there. And so they could detonate a civil war in Syria to blow up any chance of peace between Iran and Israel and to continue to destabilize the region, because they will not stop until they have a regime change in Iran.
Okay, so everything you said probably makes the most, I don't want to say probably, it does make the most sense of everything I've read and heard, because none of that, this escalation made any sense. From Iran having nuclear capabilities, and I say that, and I don't know if they do or not, for the record, but I remember I watched a video of Netanyahu 30 years ago advocating for basically the occupation of Iran and taking them out. That was 30 years ago because they were so close to a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
And then that has been the story really for the past 30 years, every, I don't know, it could have been months or every few months or every few years, they come out with how we need to go in and attack Iran. And that was from Netanyahu himself.
And yeah, then, Netanyahu has pretty much been, Iran is on the verge of having nuclear weapon energizer bunny.
Right?
For 30 years, right?
Yeah. So again, for the record, I don't know if they do or not, but it's also, I've been hearing the same story, and this seemed like Iraq, if this was going to be an aggression from us, Iraq 2.0. And then if you even look at it and analyze it from the point of view of destabilizing the region, you'd mentioned Syria. And again, I'm no fan of Assad or Saddam Hussein or Libya, Gaddafi for the, that matter. Every single time we've gone in there, it's been complete civil war. It's been complete destabilizing the region. And in fact, we have terrorists that are not friendly to the U.S. now in charge, if you would. Just name your favorite country. And it also didn't make sense of, what was it, 6-8 weeks ago when Trump was in Saudi and he was having a hero's welcome. Obviously, there were talks about, hey, this is, I don't want to say obviously, but it seems to me there were talks, okay, this is going to escalate. This is what we're going to do. And it more than likely had Saudi's blessing, not as an occupational, because I don't think they would stand for that. But hey, this will help us broker in peace. So if I guess you put the chess pieces or you analyze the chess pieces, taking away the emotion, what you just said just makes the most sense. But work that out more for me. Talk about what's going to happen to Israel now. You just mentioned that Netanyahu will more than likely be voted out of office and could very well end up in jail. I know he has a lot of legal trouble there and he's not very well liked. Correct me if I'm wrong. As well as what's going to happen now with Europe if they're not going to have a boogeyman, specifically the British, they're not going to have a boogeyman anymore. And then it seems like also the Russians were involved when they would publicly say, but it's very ambiguous what they would say about what their involvement would be. It seemed like they were very restrained, and I'm sure there were back channels talking directly with Putin.
Yeah, they're not giving away the game, you know, and neither are Iranians, but it is, you know, regardless of any of that, they do have like a comprehensive partnership agreement with Russia. I mean, between Russia and Iran. And they have the same as a similar agreement with China. And the Chinese have pretty much designated Iran as the anchor of the new security architecture for the Middle East. So, you know, Iran is extremely important to them, particularly under the current government. They don't want a regime change because they're also counting on Iran as a major component in the north-south international transport corridor, which is a faster, cheaper, shorter alternative to the Suez route. So, you know, a globally extremely important transport route now is going to go from the Indian Ocean across a handful of large Iranian port up towards the Caspian Sea, and then from there towards Moscow and St. Petersburg, and then from the Baltics, it can serve European ports. Well, it's a very, very different game from, you know, the trade route through Suez and the Mediterranean and all the way around to, you know, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Antwerp, and these places that at Hamburg. So, you know, it sidelines Europeans as the masters of the maritime trade a little bit, which they don't like because they've had that primacy for many centuries now. And so obviously they would like a regime change in Iran to blow that up, basically. Primarily the British, because, you know, this is always, well, always, this has been, you know, the Middle East has been one of their focal points of their foreign policy for the last two centuries, basically. And they've been largely in charge. And there's, you know, today, it seems that the British are very, very heavily represented in Damascus. you know, and it's not, you know, it's not like personnel of the Foreign Office. They work through proxies. They work through non-government organizations, through private contractors, through charities. You know, they set up charities, which, you know, find something clever to do there to, you know, so they can show that they help people. You know, they love to help with education. In spite of the fact that Syria, the Syrian people are some of the most highly educated people in the world, the British are very, very concerned about helping with education in Syria. And we already know from 2016, 2017, you know, that when they've been also helping the education of Palestinians in the West Bank, and then they got busted because what their role, you know, they paid something like 30,000 teachers in the West Bank. But the curriculum that they fund is a curriculum that favors radicalization of Muslim youth. You know, so it kind of glorifies martyrdom and fighting for freedom and so on. So they, you know, like they like to lay down the dry tinder for when they need to destabilize somewhere. So, you know, now they want to educate the Syrian people as well. And so I think that they're not doing this because they're idle. They're not doing this to amuse themselves. They're doing this because they want to reassert themselves as the colonial power, as they say, east of Suez, you know. So they want to, you know, control the whole region from the East Mediterranean and Egypt all the way eastward towards to Pakistan. And so, you know, they are still a very potent destabilization factor. But and then, you know, the United States is only called upon when you need to apply blunt power, you know, when you need to bomb somebody, when you need to bring the carrier strike groups. Otherwise, it's the British who work the thing through secret diplomacy and intelligence agencies and all these NGOs and private contractors and charities and so forth. And what happened, in fact, is that the United States has found itself a little bit shafted in Syria. Because the U.S. proxies in Syria is the Free Syrian Army, which is, you know, it's, well, there's some remnants of it, but it's not what it was in 2012. And then the Kurds, but the Kurds are in open hostility with the Turkish state. And then the Turkish deep state is fully in cahoots with the British in managing and maneuvering these HTS, you know, jihadis, former al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda in Syria. And so now, you know, the United States is at a point where the only good move is to simply withdraw from Syria, because the alternative is getting enmeshed in a big civil war. And their opponents are Turkey, Great Britain, and their proxy, HTS, which means that potentially their ally, if they remain in Syria, could be the Iranians. So it's very complicated, but it's also very interesting. And I think that Trump has played a good hand this time.
Interesting. So I don't want to say that changes my perspective, but it gives me somewhat of a new perspective where, again, this seems like a 3D chess move, if you would. And if you look at it, significant loss of, I mean, the lack of, and thank God, the lack of significant loss of life on every side, as well as the lack of significant loss of assets and property. And I say that just very generally. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So go back to, and then I want to talk about Britain, but first let's go back to Israel. Israel, you see, could potentially go into a civil war, and Netanyahu, again, being thrown out or losing an election or possibly being prosecuted. Work that out for me. What does that look like and why? Why would that happen?
Okay, so Netanyahu is the only reason why he's not being prosecuted is because he's the prime minister. The day he's not the prime minister anymore, he gets prosecuted. And I think that there's enough people in Israel that absolutely hate him with a passion that he's finished. And even his political allies will drop him like a hot potato the second they don't need him anymore. So what that's going to look like, Andy, I don't know. I'd like to seek out somebody who does know, but I haven't been able to find somebody capable of saying, like, okay, so when Netanyahu's government falls, well, then this is going to happen and these people are going to come to power. It seems that nobody really knows or nobody's really sure, with the risk of a civil war breaking out. And if that happens, well, I don't know what happens. You know, it could be the end of Israel.
Yeah, that's I'm saddened, if you would, but also very interested, I guess, in all of this. Work out with me the British, because it makes sense with what you just said. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think Starmer was, I think he was at the White House, or he was talking, or the British leadership were at the White House, or at least they were talking just very recently within the past week about all of this. What happens with Britain, if you would, because it seems like if this is true, what you're saying, and I believe, again, it makes the most sense that it is, Britain, this is, yeah, because it seems the only thing they got going for them is continue a war to go and build or keep it going to supply military assets, as well as, to go and rebuild. If they don't have that, is Britain kind of implode?
Britain could implode. There are some people, some very qualified people who are experts in the domain, who say that Britain is explosively set up for a breakout of a civil war in Britain itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at civil wars through history as precedents, well, there are certain elements that are usually in place before the civil war breaks out, and apparently all of those are now flashing red for Great Britain. You know, nothing smells like civil war until there's a triggering event, and this triggering event could be something completely unexpected. You know, something that you couldn't plan on, but all of a sudden, with an avalanche, it can be just like one little piece that rolls down the hill, and then everything goes down with it. Britain is as we grew up, you know, Britain seemed to be like another advanced Western countries, but it appears that the ambition to go back to colonialism, to go back to expanding empire, is still very much alive and well. And I don't know when that happened. It seems to me that they started moving earnestly maybe about 10 years ago, maybe 2014, maybe a little bit earlier, 2012. But then, you know, the ideological, you know, direction, the mission, may have happened in the immediate aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, once the Cold War is over, I guess the British establishment faced the choice: are we going to be a neutral island nation, mining our business and, you know, building a good economy and prosperity, kind of like Switzerland maybe or Norway? Or do we go back to being an empire? And it seems to me that they decided to go, well, it's pretty obvious that they decided to go with the empire stuff. And then, you know, they had that marketing campaign where instead of saying rule Britannia, like in the 19th century, under Tony Blair, they came up with the new slogan, cool Britannia. You know, they wanted to be, you know, the cool hip empire. And then I guess that didn't, they kind of got old. So now at some point they started calling it global Britain. But it's very obvious that they have started to move towards their former African colonial possessions and some French ones like Cameroon. The Middle East and certain parts of Southeast Asia. Okay, so remember in 2012, Jake Sullivan, who worked on directly under Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State back then, he wrote her a memo saying that, oh, by the way, in Syria, Al-Qaeda is on our side. Yeah. Okay, so where did he come up with that? At the time, so that's 2012, right? There was a man called Powell, Jonathan Powell, who started up a private contractor called Intermediate, two words, Intermediate. And he set up shop and he started working with all these jihadi groups in the Middle East. And he started coordinating and working with them with the objective of taking down the government of Bashar al-Assad. And then, you know, late 2011, 2012, we started to have that civil war in Syria where all these jihadi groups got together and started to attack the Syrian regime under Bashar al-Assad. And apparently the person who was coordinating that, at least in large part, was Jonathan Powell. He was the one who has been cultivating al-Jolani, you know, the current president of Syria, since that time, because in 2011, al-Jolani was in prison for terrorism in Iraq, and then mysteriously he got freed. And at that point, Jonathan Powell's communication with him and other al-Qaeda operatives becomes, you know, something. It starts to become extensive. So Jonathan Powell? He used to be Tony Blair's chief of staff while Tony Blair was the prime minister. And he's pretty much been, the Syria has been his assignment pretty much since 2012. And part of that was to rebrand the jihadis, you know, to trim their beards and put on nice suits and train them how to communicate with Western audiences, you know, to rebrand them from, you know, moderate head choppers to, you know, progressive reformers seeking to bring freedom and democracy in Syria. And if you need to see showcasing of this work, then Jonathan Powell's former boss, Tony Blair, in January of this year, interviewed Assad al-Shibani, the current foreign minister of Syria, of all places, in Davos at the World Economic Forum. And there you can see al-Shibani kind of do the interview with Tony Blair. And, you know, after 25, 26 minutes of that interview, you think like, oh, this al-Shibani, he's such a wonderful man. I want to take him home, right? I want to adopt him. But he was in his, you know, when Jonathan Powell found him and dusted him off, he was one of the founders of Al-Qaeda in Syria, right? So we're still talking jihadi head choppers. And so that's the role of Britain. And now they're doing pretty much the same playbook in Bosnia and Herzegovina, where they, you know, in the Balkans, which they pretty much designated as the next front in the conflict between the Western powers and Russia. And by the way, that communication between Jonathan Powell and Jake Sullivan in 2012, Powell also asked Sullivan to inform Hillary Clinton that similar kind of work that they started in Syria, so, you know, building out these extensive networks with the jihadis, they started the same in three other nations that he named. One of them was Yemen, Somalia, and Myanmar. And so now you can kind of spot the pattern, what Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Myanmar had in common over these past 13 years. They've been nonstop at the receiving end of terror attacks, assassinations, regime change, and including civil wars. So, you know, this is the work that they have been doing. And they're, again, you know, they're not doing it to amuse themselves. They're doing it because they want to clear a path towards reclaiming their imperial glory of, you know, 18th and 19th centuries. And so they want to recolonize all those parts of the world which are either of geostrategic importance, or they're rich in natural resources, or both. So Southeast Asia, Middle East, Africa, including Nigeria, Cameroon, Tanzania, Kenya, pretty much that whole East Africa strip from Egypt down to South Africa.
Got it. And I'll take off my humanitarian hat here and then just talk about strategy and really.
You mean you're going to take off your white helmet, right?
That's right. let's talk about strategy and really just winners and losers. Ironically, it seems like Iran will be a winner in this, ironically, but I'd also specifically say it seems to me like Russia and also China are big winners in this, and perhaps Trump is a big winner in this. What are your thoughts, I guess, on winners and losers here as things play out, knowing full well this is very dynamic?
Yeah, all things being equal, it would appear that Russia, China, Iran, not necessarily in order, are the big winners. Israel and the Western European powers are the big losers. And the United States is also a big winner here because, you know, they are, let's not forget, you know, at the beginning of Trump administration, before even the beginning of, you know, 15th January, 2025, Marco Rubio was at his confirmation hearings at the Senate. And he said two things. He said, post-World War II global order is more than obsolete and is being weaponized against the United States at this time. And the second thing he said is that multipolar integrations are the new reality in the world, and the United States intends to embrace this. So, you know, they found, I mean, unless that was a con job to, you know, get all their supporters on board, if they actually mean what they're saying, then that means that the United States has the intention of embracing multipolar integrations, which means cutting deals with the Russians, with the Iranians, with the Chinese, with the Indians, and, you know, joining these groups of nations as a major power, but not as the hegemon, not as the global policeman, right? So that would be the winners. The losers would be the Israelis and the Western Europeans, particularly the British. But again, you know, all things are never equal and things are not going to stay static. My prediction would be, if I had to bet money on it, my prediction would be that the British are going to seek to trigger a civil war in Syria, and that will, you know, draw in not only the Iranians, but also the Israelis and the Turks and the United States and possibly Russia. That is, you know, Russia has packed up to go. So they're still there in Tartus, but, you know, with their bags packed so they can, you know, quickly load up their ships and you know, say sayonara. But, you know, if you wanted to sabotage peace, then you would get something going in Syria. And I suspect that the British will get something going in Syria.
Do you think that escalation with Russia in all of this will happen? Or do you think Russia, as you said, will really pack their bags and potentially go home? I think that's what you said. Or do you think Russia...
You mean in Syria?
Yeah.
I think that the Russians will not stay if a civil war breaks out. I very much doubt that they will stay, or they will have to demand security guarantees from HTS or from the Turkish state or from whoever. But, you know, the British have already, you know, they already got caught since the HTS took power last December. You know, the Brits already got caught coordinating units of these jihadi militias to attack the Russians in Tartus. So they will probably do this again. And in that case, you know, the Russians have no reason to stay. They are now present in Libya and Algeria. So they will not get ejected from the Mediterranean if they leave Syria. But I think that they will be very, very careful not to get enmeshed in a quagmire that, you know, might just cost them casualties and getting drawn deeper into a conflict that's only indirectly theirs. But they will probably continue to support the Iranians. And I think Iranians will continue to support Hamas and Hezbollah in the region. So we'll see what happens, but my bet would be that the Russians are going to pack and go.
Yeah, it's just, it's a fascinating time, really, it's extremely interesting. And it looks like when the dust is being settled somewhat, I say that somewhat knowing full well that this is very dynamic, it's not static, that again, we go right back to what things were. And that's away from Western, the East, if you would. And I say that the Middle East, China, and Russia getting away from Western hegemony, I hope I say that right, and power, if you would, and really developing their own resources and their own alliances to build their own economies and their own structure or whatever they want to have.
Yes, you know, and I think that would be nice. It would be consistent with Trump's speech in Riyadh a few weeks ago. It would be consistent with J.D. Vance's statement just yesterday that this is, that peace between Iran and Israel is the beginning of the new era of peace and prosperity for the region. That would all be nice because, you know, we've been our everyday reality for the past century plus has been basically the result of British geopolitics, you know, as defined as, okay, let's say not invented, but at least articulated by Halford Mackinder at the turn of the last century. And basically the idea was, yeah, this is kind of big. We can't police it all with military and you know, police forces. So what we're going to do instead, we're just going to do divide and rule. We're just going to pit people one against the other, keep them permanently at war, keep them permanently dependent upon us for financial support and weaponry. And they will all be in debt to us up to their eyeballs, and they will have to turn their natural resources over to our corporations, who, importantly, will fund those developments from our banks. And I think that's, you know, that's always been, it always is, the name of the game for these colonial powers.
Yeah, I would agree exactly with that. And it will be very nice, again, having a relationship that is based on trade and development as opposed to regime change. And whether that's the British or the U.S. Starting or intermediate going into some kind of war. So I would agree. Alex, I want to thank you. We'll end on that. I want to thank you so much. You are one of the best analysts that I know of on all of this. And you're also off camera told my viewers and listeners, Alex is extremely accommodating to me and also just very humble and just quite the gentleman off camera. I just want to thank you for that. Alex, if people want more of you, how do they find you? What do they offer? Tell us about your Substack and the services that you offer.
Thank you, Andy. Well, it's always a pleasure to join you. So I have two publications on Substack. One of them is called iSystem Trend Compass, which is a daily news trend following newsletter for investors and traders, which provides, you know, directional exposure and timings buy sell signals for about 18 markets, including gold and Bitcoin and, you know, things like S&P 500, NASDAQ, 10-year treasury note, 30-year treasury bond, things like that. My other publication is a personal Substack called Alex Craner's Substack, where I publish a bit less frequently, but I tend to publish more thoroughly researched and better refined articles. At least that's the endeavor. And then I'm pretty active on X, but my ex presence is pretty much like, you know, pub banter. You know, I just shoot my mouth.
Well, keep on shooting your mouth. I'm a big follower of yours on X.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy. Take care. It was great to join you today. And until the next time.
Absolutely. Love to have you on again soon as things are always changing and unraveling. I'll put everything in the show notes on both the YouTube channel, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I want to thank you so much, Alex. You're always great to me.
Pleasure. Thank you, Andy. Take care.
Take care.